This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll hear about work being done to build a queer archive of Central Coast LGBTQ history.
There is a fear that those stories will be lost and that a younger generation may not be aware of really what happened during that time.
And later, there is plenty of new construction in the growing city of San Luis Obispo. One is a brand new hotel right in the middle of downtown.
78 rooms isn't a big addition, but then you put the two restaurants, the catering and the conference space, and the three bars and the spa, you've really got a little development up there on the hill.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It is Monday, October 14th, 2019. I'm Tyler Pratt. California schools don't have enough teachers, and a big reason why is the cost of housing. Now, a growing number of school districts across the state are considering a creative solution, building their own teacher housing on school district land. As part of the California Dream Collaboration's look at solutions to some of the state's problems, Erica Mahoney reports from member station KAZU on the Central Coast community of Monterey.
L. Wiley's classroom is lined with twinkle lights. Math pictures cover the walls. She teaches Integrated Math 1 at Soquel High School, east of Santa Cruz. And she buys most of these classroom supplies herself. She says it's just one more thing to pay for each school year.
I can tell you I lived off of leftovers that students gave me for food for a couple weeks this year.
What's really draining her bank account is the cost of rent. About 40% of her monthly paycheck goes toward housing.
Every year I have the same question to myself. Am I going to be here this year? Am I going to teach here next year?
When Wiley was hired in 2016, she spent part of that year sleeping on a couch. She struggled for months to find somewhere affordable to live. Being a dog owner didn't help. Fast forward, and she now rents a room in a coworker's house. But Wiley says she's going to have to move soon, and she's running out of options. She's thinking about moving back home to Chico.
I feel like giving up, 100%. I love the school, I love my colleagues, I love my administration, I love my district office. I just personally cannot keep fighting for a place to live.
A recent study by USA Today ranks Santa Cruz as the least affordable city in the U.S. for teachers. San Jose and San Francisco ranked as the second and third least affordable places. To help, some California school districts are building their own housing for teachers. A state law passed in 2016 makes it easier by allowing districts to put teacher housing on district-owned property. At a former elementary school north of Santa Cruz, Dr. Lori Bruton walks up stairs that overlook a 28-acre schoolyard.
And you could see it's really a beautiful campus.
Bruton is superintendent of the San Lorenzo Valley Unified School District. She says this elementary school has been closed for 17 years. Now, the plan is to turn the classrooms into 33 below-market apartments for teachers.
The classrooms are bright, and there's a lot of greenery around, and there's a lot of flat space. So you can see, like, this is a great patio right here at the entrance of this classroom.
The project is estimated to cost the district nearly $10 million. Bruton hopes the investment will help hire and keep teachers around. And she says that will ultimately help the students.
If you're a young teacher and you raise a family in this area and your kids go to school here, that's a whole different level of ownership to the community and to the school.
It allows housing in a location we never thought about it before. And that's phenomenal. We should do more of that.
Billy Riggs is a professor at the University of San Francisco School of Management.
We potentially have people traveling less. There is an environmental co-benefit there that cannot be dismissed.
Riggs would like to see California embrace workforce housing for all kinds of professions. But he says that 2016 Teacher Housing Act is a step in the right direction.
We should allow more housing in places where people work.
San Mateo Community College and Santa Clara Unified have already built employee housing, to name a few. Now, school districts across the state are exploring the option, including where L. Wiley teaches, Santa Cruz City Schools. She says she would move into teacher housing in a heartbeat, but doubts that solution will be available anytime soon.
I just know in my head, I can't even think about it because I know it's not going to happen, so I can't get my dreams up like that.
But just last month, Santa Cruz City Schools took their exploration one step forward. It's now in the process of hiring an architect to start making plans for their teacher housing, just behind the Natural Bridges High School campus. In Santa Cruz, I'm Erica Mahoney.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. Last Friday was National Coming Out Day, a celebration of coming out as lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, or queer. To honor the occasion, a Central Coast group is unveiling a project a long time in the making, the Central Coast Queer Archive Project. The group has unveiled two restored oral histories with members of the Central Coast LGBTQ community that dive into what queer life was like here more than 20 years ago. The Central Coast Queer Archive Project is a volunteer effort that currently involves members of the academic and student communities at Cal Poly and Cuesta College, along with local advocates and professionals. I recently sat down with community activist David Wiseman, Dr. Zach McKiernan from Cuesta College, and Cal Poly student Michael Morris about the project's intergenerational and interactive approach to storytelling.
The Central Coast Queer Archive Project is meant to elevate queer history here in San Luis Obispo by two principal things is identifying queer spaces, both in the present and historically, and also creating an archive to make accessible to community members to help connect and create community.
I wasn't aware of the project until about July of 2018. And I wouldn't have known about it at all if it hadn't been for a newspaper story in the Tribune that came out, which was really related to the fact that the History Center had flown a pride flag during Pride Week and that the flag had been vandalized. Now, in the context of the story, the vandalism turned out to be less the issue, but somehow they ferreted out that there was this queer archive project going on within the History Center. And this motivated some antipathy on the part of certain political and community figures who were very concerned why History Center would be doing something with a special group like this. Was that some sort of, was a line being crossed in that way? And there was a response editorial by Zach and some of the others, and certainly the editorial board of the Tribune, who said, yeah, the pride flag is perfectly fine to be flown from the History Center during Pride Week. That's not crossing any lines. But buried in that, it said there was this queer archive project, and having worked on oral history projects before, I thought, hey, well, I think I'm going to go down and I'd like to find out about this. And so I think that's when we first all met. And I think at the time, the idea was that a lot of the oral history was going to be just recorded. It was an audio-only thing. And I kind of made the case of moving it to video because, as we explained, when you do an audio history, just like a transcript from a court proceeding, you see the words on paper, but sometimes the context is lost. Irony, for example, the raised eyebrow, the sneer that accompanies something can change entirely the meaning of the words. And, when we were working in Texas, we'd interview someone, an activist, and they say, oh, yeah, sure, we just love George Bush here in Texas. Uh-huh. And they'd curl their lip and make a sneer. But you see, if you just read the transcript, you might assume they really did love him. Same thing here is the emotion is carried by the expressions. I think if anyone looks at our recent interview with Lisa Dean, one of the first people who we've interviewed as a new participant in the project, there are moments when in the clip, which you can find on our website, which, by the way, is slowqueerarchive.org, she begins to talk about why the first gay club in San Luis sort of was a dissolution, why it sort of fell apart. And there's a pause, and she kind of sighs. And there's a facial gesture that says, I'm so sad that this is what became of our community. And then she launches into the litany of problems. Unaccompanied by that sigh and the facial gesture, one doesn't really get the sense of sadness and loss that was implied. And that's, I think, a reason we make a pitch for having this on video, because the picture really is worth more than 1,000 words, though goodness knows Michael has sat and transcribed the thousands of words without the picture as well, which is, I guess, its own unique experience.
Mm-hmm. Let me follow up on that, because what the Central Coast Queer Archive Project is doing, we've also located oral histories that were conducted by Gala in 2004 and 2005 that were literally in the closet, and we've taken them off the shelf. And these were done with queer elders. A few have since passed. And going back to David's point of the importance of the visual part, Michael has just done an incredible work of transcribing a couple. And to see them on film interacting with one another with gestures and smiles, sort of little head nods and winks, it provides again a context that would be lost if it were just a plain transcription. The project is building on previous work that's done with oral histories in San Luis Obispo here, and then of course Michael, I'll let him speak to this, was an important part in helping transcribe these interviews.
Hey Michael, I'll jump to you. So I'm having flashbacks right now of my beginning days of being a radio producer, mm-hmm. and the first thing that I was doing was just transcribing hours and hours of audio. So I don't envy you in mm-hmm. this process, but tell me, what did you learn going through all of these videos?
Yeah, well, so one main purpose of this project is to create a historical archive, and the interview of the couple was 2 hours long. So, you know, they talked about like their life experiences, what was like coming out, all these different things, but they also gave a lot of interesting pieces of history for the like LGBTQ community. One interesting thing they talked about was they were saying around like 1991 or 1992, the city of San Luis Obispo was, they had a piece of legislation that was going to give the LGBTQ community equal rights in housing and employee benefits. And the city had a public hearing. And Carol, one of the ladies in the interview, said around like 1,500 people showed up. And there were like 60 or 70 people that spoke in favor of both sides. And SLO ended up not passing the legislation, which was just interesting because that's like 25 or so years ago. So that was interesting. They talked about other instances like that, but they also just gave some advice from their viewpoint as elders just about life.
So with this equal rights and benefits hearing, were y'all able to go back and track this down through city archives?
So I just finished this transcription this past weekend. So these are still things we need to like delve into and do our own research on in this, like, to create a historical archive. So we haven't delved a lot into them yet, but we will.
The same thing happens with our interview with Lisa Dean. Lisa, who works as a CPA here in San Luis now, from 1992 to 1998, was the co-owner and manager of Breezes, which many people, again, didn't realize was the first openly gay bar in San Luis Obispo. In the interview we did with her, which is on our, again, on our website at slowqueerarchive.org, and there's a 90-minute interview, and then there's a 5-minute excerpt where she explains there had been a smaller club called Journeys Inn that was where the Shalimar Indian restaurant is or was until recently. And it was just a hole-in-the-wall place, but it wasn't overtly open. And she explains how, with some investors, there came to be the idea to create an open place in what is now the Laguna Shopping Center and what is now the Sushiya Japanese restaurant for today's generation. And when we did a test screening of this video among a group of youth from the Queer Crowd, which is an activist group in San Luis, this group was younger. They were 19 to 25 poly students, recent graduates. And when they saw images we used from Lisa's personal photo album that she gave us as part of the archive of other young people in a place like this in San Luis, decorated to the nines with rainbow flags and various bits of paraphernalia, there was an audible hush in the room followed by like, huh? Like they were saying, wait a minute, what was this? When was this? Like, but those people look like us. Yes. Yes. And why isn't there a place like this now? There was one in San Luis. And in the interview, in great length, Lisa explains why, for economic reasons, for issues involving the clientele, that it didn't last. But it is getting some excitement, right? Because the young people are now starting to wonder, well, wait a minute, it's a quarter of a century later. Things have changed. Why isn't there a place like this in San Luis now? And I think as Zach's lessons in the role of public history show, sometimes history can motivate activism.
Absolutely, and build community. And there's also, of course, the special sensitivity to place. I mean, people bond emotionally to place. People connect to place. People meet at places. And if communities don't have these meeting places, or just like an archive, a repository for memory, then there's a real potential at a sense of erasure. And that's exactly what we're trying to prevent. The project is, instead of erasing queer history, we're trying to elevate it, promote community building, promote activism, and promote the use of public spaces for the LGBTQ plus community.
Now, this interview is going to be airing after y'all are having a big event, but this event coming up feels like a big coming together of the queer community to celebrate this queer archive and maybe get some of this ball rolling of getting the queer community in San Luis Obispo or the Central Coast together?
I'd like Michael to take up this question, because when Michael was transcribing the interview with Carol Leslie, the owner of Volumes of Pleasure in Los Osos, she was interviewed in 2004 with her partner, Barbara. But Michael said something to us, he shared with us through the transcription, that Carol said that, you know, we need to hang out across generations. You know, we need to get together and we need to tell stories and we need to sort of bond in friendly ways. So for me, as the public historian who understands the sort of the scholarship and the importance of, you know, of spaces, of physical spaces as places of activism, repositories for memory, you know, to be able to come back to this place, the only, you know, openly gay place in San Luis Obispo for about a decade, I mean, is quite powerful. And so I'm curious to know what, you know, Michael thinks about this sort of reunification around place.
Yeah, well, just
sorry to put you on the spot, Michael.
No,
but as worries. the representative of the sort of next or young generation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so towards the end of the interview, one of the last questions that was asked of the couple was along the lines of, you know, this is kind of the end of the interview. Is there anything else you have to say? Is there any advice you would give to the people who are going to be watching this video? And they had talked throughout the interview about their view on technology, and more people are spending more time with, you know, their computers and with people on the internet instead of being with people in person. The main thing they said was that don't be afraid of people, and particularly people of different generations. They talked fondly about some of their younger friends they had in their 30s that they liked to hang out with. And they just talked about the importance of hanging out with people, having dinner, people of like all different walks of life, and learning what they have to say. And I think there's definitely an importance to that. And there's a little bit of truth behind people spending more and more time away from people. So I think this will be a good event for everyone of all different backgrounds, parts of life.
David, why don't you go ahead and describe what's going to be happening, or what happened on Friday?
Yeah, what we did is a combination of things. The project website is going to go live on Friday, October 11th, with the interviews that you can watch the video streaming and download the PDF files of the written transcripts that Michael and others have worked on. And we want to make this available as a research tool, as a historical tool, that it's all downloadable and accessible. So the quickest and hopefully witty thing I can say, as Zach mentioned, the old interviews that had languished in a closet in Gala at the Gay and Lesbian Alliance of San Luis, we can appropriate the famous rallying cry from Stonewall 50 years later, right, and say, out of the closets and onto the screens, as opposed to the streets, as the rallying cry back in the day. And to celebrate this going live with the website, we're going to go back to what is now the Sushia restaurant, which was the site of the Breezes nightclub in the 1990s, and invite the community. The original meaning of a queer night out, when that as a sort of a semi-radical political act started decades ago, was when in the gay community, and I think both Michael and Zach spoke to this, there's a loss of public spaces. Everyone's now on Grindr or Tinder or something. They aren't meeting to hook up anymore, and so the gay bars began to fade, and we have seen more and more of them closing, and that it becomes an electronic space rather than an in-person space, especially in a small community like San Luis that didn't have a lot to support a gay bar in the first place. So Queer Night Out was an attempt, radical gang, I wouldn't use the word radical gang, but they would. It was definitely an agitprop event. A flash mob would form and groups of queer people would go to say that the place that had been a gay bar was now a Bennigan's or a TGI Fridays. And they would just come in on a Friday night en masse, 60, 100 of them, and sort of re-queer the place. Well, in this case, of course, it's a Japanese restaurant, Sushiya, in San Luis Obispo in the Laguna Shopping Center. And we're not going to storm the place. I've met with the owners in advance. I've told them that we're coming. I've asked if we can use their large screen TV behind the bar to run a video montage of Lisa's photo albums of what the pictures of the place and the people who went there looked like 25 years ago. So we're doing this in cooperation with them. But the idea is on National Coming Out Day, Friday, October 11th, we will re-queer the Sushiya Japanese restaurant, much as it had been when it was the Breezes nightclub a quarter of a century ago, and once again have a queer presence in what was the only openly public gay space in San Luis back at the time.
That's community activist David Wiseman, Cuesta College professor Zach McKiernan, and Cal Poly student Michael Morris talking about the recently unveiled Central Coast Queer Archive Project. Later in the conversation, we dove into what they hope the project will become and what the future of queer gathering spaces could look like on the Central Coast.
Now that we have a website presence, part of it's going to be developing a list of, okay, who do we interview next? I hate to say there's a ruthless triage, but the elders get more elder every day. And so one would hope we can gather some of those stories before they've passed on. And we will be taking names. I think we'll have a clipboard at the event and people who know people. Or that's how oral histories happen. It's like, oh, you know, have you spoken to so-and-so? And that's where you find out about it. Or in some ways, they literally do come out of the closets or out of the woodwork to say, yeah, have you spoken to or you really need to talk to if you want to know what was going on in San Luis back in the day. And so begin to develop a list of who's next on the list. And then we'll begin applying for grants because this has been an all-volunteer effort here. Everyone is working as a volunteer. But if we have to travel to get interviews, among other things, too, we need hard drive storage because this is all done digitally. You know, when a lot of these interviews were done on tape, the gala interviews that we rescued from the closet, those are on antiquated video formats that just luckily I keep old machines going back to VHS and I'm able to restore these things. But even with today's technology, you need terabytes and terabytes of storage to store all of these interviews. And then our other colleagues, Charlie Greenlee and Mary Waters. Mary's with the San Luis Art Museum, and she's into arts administration, so she's got a great command of those processes. And she's studying it at Poly and Cuesta. She has an English degree. We'll all be formulating lists of how we can take and interpret the material, how to categorize it, and how to make it accessible for both advocacy, for history, and searchable, indexable. So this really becomes San Luis's go-to online source for the LGBTQ history.
If anyone's listening right now and they think, oh, I've got a photo album lying around from 25, 30 years ago, or have an old VHS or tape, what would be the next steps for them if they wanted to unearth that and bring it to you guys?
Please visit our website at slowqueerarchive.org, and you'll have a contact us. And let us know what you have. Right now, we don't have a huge physical space for the library. We are working with the Autumn Ford, another one of our participants. She is a student at Poly and is working with the special collections at the Kennedy Library to develop a permanent repository for this material. We have found a photo album from when San Luis Obispo used to have a very lively Mardi Gras scene before the year early 2000s when for various police protection and other reasons, they kind of shut down that. But yeah, there was a lively crowd for that. And so if people do have those kinds of photo albums or VHS tapes, if anyone has early footage of the first Pride festivals in San Luis or anything going back that far, yeah, visit us and contact us via that website, slowqueerarchive.org. And we will get back in touch with you.
And another thing that we'd like to do with the project, I know that Stephen and I, on the academic side of it, we would like to use the project as a model in future curriculum in oral history courses or in queer studies or anything along those lines. So we're, again, with the elevation of the history and the maturation of the project and the institutionalization of this information, Stephen and I know are looking forward to implementing this in the curriculum at Cuesta and Cal Poly.
And there's always fun things that, you know, young folks, I just speak as right.
Training
as
future historians.
I'm old. You know, that's... There is a lost generation, and I'm not comparing this, say, to the Shoah Foundation or the Shoah Project that Steven Spielberg started on, but that is the granddaddy of all these oral history video projects that somehow it could be forgotten. Likewise, it's being discussed in queer theory now. There's an entire generation of mostly gay men who are in their late 50s or early 60s who managed to live through what was the worst of the AIDS scourge in the 80s and the 90s. And many of them are reticent and quiet about it because there was such a deal of loss. But like the Shoah itself, which it kind of was in that sense, there is a fear that those stories will be lost and that a younger generation of gay men or advocates may not be aware of really what happened during that time. And so part of it is also getting that history out. And that's, I think, the intergenerational nature of it is making sure, much as Michael mentioned, both Carol and Barbara in their interview talked about, is sharing this within the community. You know, how many young queer people have a grandparent age person they can talk to about this? And for how many people was that an important relationship in their lives, the wisdom of that person? And maybe they don't have it in their biological family, but they can find it in this adopted family, if you will. I mean, that's what fascinated me about it was Michael learned a few things about the encoding of gay behavior from Barbara and Carol. I'm sure he didn't know how they managed to communicate with each other in the old days. And
yeah, one of the things that Carol and Barbara talked about in the interview back in the 80s or so when they were living in Laguna Beach, they were part of a lesbian women's group. And one of the events they had was they had these women from all different generations going back all the way to the 20s, like the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s. They kind of went in order, and all these women shared their stories. And in particular, they talked about if you were interested in someone, how you would let them know. And so they were saying the women in the 20s, they would, there were certain like hand gestures and facial things you would do to kind of let people know. And then that moved on where eventually when they were coming out, they would say, hey, have you read this book by this lesbian author? The other person would say, yes. Have you also read this book by this other lesbian author? And they would go, yeah, yeah. Yeah, that was definitely a little interesting. And so also going forward with the project, one of the things I mean I would like to do is delve into these interesting pieces of history that were mentioned in these interviews and making that part of the archive as well.
That's, and I think that's really great because what it does, it's creating community, it's inspiring advocacy and activism, but it's also inspiring young scholars to embark on careers in scholarship.
And it is very refreshing to find someone who actually wishes to embark on scholarship when everything else seems to be turning towards a kind of rampant consumerism and materialism. That's a really refreshing and hopeful and inspiring thing. And that applies to the other young folks who are involved with this project as well. They're seriously committed to this kind of history and social change, which we definitely need in our society today.
People that come to visit or hear about the Central Coast are often surprised to hear there is not a dedicated queer space. There's not a consistent queer space. Do you see that changing in the future? Does anyone have any thoughts or would like to speculate?
You're quite right, Tyler, because I've done the research. Trust me, I've looked. And there was places in Santa Barbara in the past. And in the interview we did with Lisa Dean, she mentions the locations were not up to classy standards at the time. I've looked. There's nothing in Santa Cruz. And I would have thought a major college town like Santa Cruz would have had something. And, like, there isn't. So you're right. Between here and San Jose, Los Angeles and San Jose, there are no spaces. What our hope would be is the kind of young people who got inspired by seeing a place like this could begin to put some momentum behind it. I joke, as a Morro Bay resident, that there's a bar, was a dive bar in North Morro Bay.
The Buoy?
The Buoy, that had gone out of business a year ago August, and it has a for lease sign up on top of it. And I just on a lark, I went and looked it up, and they want $4,000 a month is the rent. Now, I don't know anything about the retail food and beverage industry or what that would be. But I'm wondering if
so this is probably not a great venture for you. But anyone out there listening, right,
yeah, I mean, anyone who understands these things might look into it. You know, we do have some stuff. For example, there's a slow gay meetup group, and we've begun having a kind of a queer night out at the Broad Street Public House. And the owners there are very supportive allies, and they'll get 20, 30 people will show up at events like this. Now, they're not daily, but there are enough reasons. So maybe the answer is, if there's not a dedicated space, that we do begin at least as a start to have dedicated evenings, dedicated events that are special. And in the interview, you will hear Lisa Dean explains exactly why Breezes eventually went out of business, because there weren't enough people at that time to support a bar like that operating full time. Rents were going up. Cost of labor. You learn all the intricacies of running a food and beverage establishment that made it difficult to support that in the 90s. But that was the 90s.
So here's my take. I think the sky's the limit. And I always sort of revert back to the question, what type of community or what type of city is San Luis Obispo? I want, as a citizen of San Luis Obispo County, I want San Luis Obispo to be a city that has an openly queer space. When I reflect on my city and when I want people to think about what they think about San Luis Obispo, I don't want them to say, oh, San Luis Obispo, they don't have a designated gay bar. To me, this is a sort of a travesty. So the question I ask myself, what type of city is San Luis Obispo? And I want to be able to answer that. San Luis Obispo is a city that has designated queer spaces.
That was Dr. Zach McKiernan from Cuesta College, Cal Poly student Michael Morris, and community activist David Wiseman talking about the Central Coast Queer Archive Project. They recently unveiled two restored oral histories from members of the Central Coast's queer community. To see the interviews and for more information about the project, you can visit slo.queerarchive.org.
Yeah.
We're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll talk about a hot new trend here on the Central Coast. Electric bikes.
These, you go ride them around, you really enjoy them. Everyone comes back with a huge smile on their face. They're super fun.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas.
Dave Schultz. I own the bike shop in Morro Bay, California, and I've owned the shop for 6 years.
The bike shop has been a part of the American community since the 1880s, 1890s, but it's evolved.
Times change constantly. It's to the point where it changes every year. There's tons of different kinds of bikes.
I mean, it's been like head spinning in the last 10 years. I mean, you just worked on my mountain bike, which is qualifying for a museum, right?
Yeah. Between there is just an incredibly diverse amount of bikes, pricing, styles, customers.
And technology. I mean, I remember when I first started riding a 10-speed, it was like, ooh, center pole brakes.
Yeah, I mean, every little genre of bikes has seen huge. The mountain bike has all the components are all modern, everything. Now we're on to the e-bikes.
E-bikes really is the current rage, isn't it?
Really is. I see it as just an evolution of bike technology. Yeah, they're incredibly fun.
What are some of the benefits? Why do people go there? Is it to be able to ride more distance, easier in commuting?
Yeah, it's just everything. You can go further, you can go up hills quite a bit easier. Yeah, pretty much the distance traveled over the same time period. I guess it's different for different people. Commuters can commute to work. You're not sweating. You just a nice bike ride up hills. Mountain bikers can go up hills easier.
Has it expanded the market? Are there people that come in that might not have the energy, you know, to ride an old-fashioned bike, but it's doable on an e-bike?
Yeah, definitely. It's, you know, all ages. Everyone's you know, the cycling community it's coming around on it. It's kind of like...
So there's a little resistance?
There's a bit of resistance within the cycling community. I think it's all going to get past that at some point.
So it's a purist issue?
To a degree, I get a lot of people, you know, you're not getting exercise, you're cheating. I like to just ride my regular bike. Yeah, the only way I can say it is that, you know, everyone's just got to try them. These pedal assist bikes, there's no throttle. It rides like a regular bike. You're just, you know, I see bikes as fun. E-bikes are fun squared. They're incredible.
Question for you. In recent years, bike rental companies, especially along the beaches, even in Hawaii and whatnot, the giant fat tire bikes, huge tires, are raging. And
well, it all started as a snow thing up in Alaska for the Iditarod race. They started doing on mountain bikes, so it started in the snow and it just transfers over to the beach. Luckily here in Morro Bay, you can ride almost anything on the beach.
So it really is for soft terrain. That's its ideal advantage.
Yeah, it's just a softer, you're getting a little bit of suspension component there, so it's a little softer.
Broader footprint too, right?
Yeah, so it works well on the sand. We've got really good beaches here for riding.
So that's a bike, just look at it, it looks like a lot more work pedaling.
It can be more work for sure. A little bit more work, but you're getting a little more comfort. These things are really popular in the snow. Probably even more so than the beach.
Interesting. But they definitely, you see them around here and you see them in Hawaii.
Yeah. And now with the e-bikes, it doesn't matter so much that it's a little harder to pedal because you've got the electric pedal assist. So you're just enjoying a nice, comfortable ride.
Back to the e-bikes. They're battery driven. What's the average life when you're using a bike?
These mid-drive ones go 30 to 60 miles. So that's about the upper end of it. You can get a good ride. You can climb up to probably 5,000 feet. You can get a good ride for sure out of one battery.
That's really cool. But from a dollar standpoint, the investment, it's an expensive bike relative to down and dirty.
Yeah, they just keep getting, you know, I guess everything's all relative, cheap and expensive. They're getting cheaper, lighter weight.
What would be an entry level electric bike?
So you've got all of the hub drive bikes, which is a lot of what you're seeing. I mean, you can get those down to hundreds of dollars.
Oh, really? I thought it was like $1,500 or so minimum.
Yeah, so there's kind of a difference between the hub drives and then you've
got... And explain hub drive.
The hub drive replaces, there's kits and there's new bikes, and it replaces the whole back wheel of the bike with the electric motor that's within the hub of the wheel. Those ones work well. Those ones can have a throttle. They work well on the flat. And then you've got these mid-drive pedal assist bikes. The ones I'm selling here are the brands Bosch and Shimano. You get an increased range with these. They ride more like a regular bike without a throttle. You're getting uphill easier and a slightly lighter weight. So really, whatever you're looking for, if you just want to go on flat grounds and you want the throttle, you'd want the cheaper. You can get these cheaper, the hub drive ones. If you want something that's more like rides like a regular bike, no throttle, gets you up hills, that's more the mid-drive bikes. So you're paying a little bit more. The ones I have in here start at $1,800 for the Bosch and Shimano mid-drive ones. And that's really what I'm kind of focusing on just because I like bikes. I like not having the throttle. The maintenance is the same and everything else. So,
do you have demos here? Somebody wanted to take one out and see if they liked it.
Yeah, I do. I've got a couple bikes here, and yeah, that's really the whole thing with these. You go ride them around, you really enjoy them. Everyone comes back with a huge smile on their face. They're super fun. So yeah, I've got bikes here, and yeah.
Roughly how many bike shops are in the county? Do you have any idea?
I don't. There's two shops just closed in San Luis Obispo recently, and I think that leaves four shops in San Luis Obispo. There's Trinity and Grover Beach.
You guys talk to each other?
occasionally, I think we're all so busy working that we never actually see each other is half the problem. Some of the other owners have come in here, and I appreciate that. I like to get along with everyone else. It's a hard industry. Shops are closing, so.
And what's the biggest battle? Why do they close?
There's just many different angles, I suppose. Everyone's going to say the internet and retail.
So there's tight margins.
Yeah, I guess there's a variety of reasons. I mean, there's the whole retail in general, retail. You know, I don't know. It's just bigger issues than I even can understand. I'm just trying to keep it small and provide good service. And
you've got to be retail to do service. I mean, you can't go online to get your bike fixed.
Yeah, I think what I'm doing is good. I'm the one-man shop. I know how to fix bikes. That's the most important thing. I was talking to Wally of Wally's Bikes in San Luis Obispo, and it's the same thing. I mean, we fix bikes first and foremost, and that's what makes it all work at the end of the day. And yeah, we try to just serve the community as best we can. I think we pretty much covered it. I'm really excited about these mid-drive pedal assist bikes. They're incredible. Hopefully people can come out and try them.
Do you ride one?
Yeah, I don't even ride my regular mountain bike anymore. I just ride my e-bike. I have tons of fun. I still like riding some other regular bikes, but I definitely like riding my e-bike a lot.
Dave, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Morro Bay, California.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. A development about 15 years in the making just opened up in SLO, Hotel San Luis Obispo. It's perched on a hill between Monterey and Palm Streets, and it's been under construction for some time, and open to speculation about how it might change the appearance of downtown. There's still a little cleaning up to do, but the hotel is now taking guests, and one of the restaurants officially opens to the public today. I recently sat down with the hotel's manager, David Smith, to learn more about the space and what it means for San Luis Obispo's future.
It's a project we started in 2005, so it's taken a little time. But the doors are finally open, and we've got our first restaurant, which will open on the 14th. But great bar when you walk into the lobby. So we're happy to be here and happy to be open finally.
Cool. Tell us about these dining options. I got a chance to eat at Piadina, which is, I guess, softly open right now. I remember your staff invited me, and it was fantastic. Y'all have a chef from the French Laundry there, is that right?
Yeah, Ryan. Ryan has worked at some pretty exclusive places, but he started in Santa Barbara, moved up to the French Laundry, did Parse in New York, and then came back, was at Barn Diva in Healdsburg for 10 years, and came on board with us. And just to talk about Ryan, I mean, he is an exceptional team leader. He came down here, and his whole team in the kitchen came with him. So they just like working for the guy. He's low-key. He's not your typical chef you might expect or you might see on TV. He's just he's solid. His food presentation is great. So we're very happy to have him, and I really enjoy working with him.
Well, like I said, in the interest of full disclosure, I got to eat there. It was fantastic. Y'all have an open kitchen where you can see everyone working. Everyone did look really calm, and the food really was absolutely phenomenal.
So. Good. And that's our first. That's our three-meal-a-day restaurant. So we have Ox and Anchor, which will probably open in a month, and that'll be our steakhouse dinner only. So you'll have some great choices, as well as just conference and catering. We just did an event for 150 people last week as well. So there's a full food and beverage team, and we'll open in stages. We'll also have a bar by the end of the year on the roof as well.
So yeah, y'all have a beautiful space. It's open. People can sort of walk through it and explore the space just right off the street, right?
Right. It's open to the public.
Well, before we get more into the hotel, just tell me about you. You're newish to the area,
yeah,
correct?
Yeah, I've been here a little over a year and a half. I moved here and love walking to work, love the weather.
Where'd you come from?
Came from originally was my most recent assignment was Northern California. I had five hotels up there, but I was commuting every week from Las Vegas. So this has been a nice change. No airplanes and walking to work. The weather, you can't beat the weather here.
So looking at the hotel, you said it got started back in 2005. It was approved by the city council, I think, 2009. Mm-hmm. So bit of a journey to get here. Tell us a little bit about that process of idea to actually opening this year.
Yeah, I think you first look at the town and say this is the ideal location for what we do as Piazza Hospitality, because all of our hotels are city center, the Healdsburg hotels, city center, town square type of thing. So we started putting the project together, purchased the property with partners, put the project together, got approved. 2008 came, which was sort of the downturn in the economy. So financing became a little bit more difficult. but came back to it about 3 years later, and then just to push forward, broke ground in really late 15, 16, and now the hotel's up. So
for those of us that live here, you know, it feels like SLO has a lot of hotels. Y'all obviously did your research, so there's a market to have more hotel rooms here. Y'all have, what, 78 rooms? Is that correct?
I have 78 guest rooms, yeah. So, and really, because of the way it's located, it's the guest rooms are there, 78, which when you look at the entire market, doesn't really sway the market in regards to what's available. 78 rooms isn't a big addition. But then you put the two restaurants, the catering and the conference space, and the three bars and the spa, you've really got a little development up there on the hill. So we did the research. We believe that there was some pent-up demand for what we were doing. And thus far, the comments have been very favorable, at least for the people that have come in since we've opened. So
it does have more of a modern and like sleek feel to it. Sort of looking at SLO, and you know, it was awarded, I think, back in like 2009 for being a downtown preservation. We've mm-hmm. got a more modern looking hotel coming here. We've got Hotel Cerro opening down the street. What does this say about sort of the changing face of like San Luis Obispo? Surely y'all have had these conversations.
I've only lived here really for less than 2 years, so I can't really comment on what it was. I mean, I've visited here. I worked on a project here about 10 years ago and decided that, you know, San Luis Obispo is the kind of town I grew up in and the kind of town that I love to live in. So in regards to that aspect, hopefully we fit in and the community embraces that. The design is thoughtful. The real trial is to try and make something that isn't just a square box. Anybody walking onto the property or parking in the parking lot across the street can walk right through the middle. We have the Paseo next to us in the Palm Theater. I mean, so there are lots of ways you can go through, and we're open that way. So the idea is to become part of the community and part of the downtown area.
One of the cool things I noticed walking through is that some of the siding you'll have is sort of like that like corrugated tin sort mm-hmm. of look that was almost kind of the same color as like the hills surrounding that. Was that intentional? Or?
Well, you know, the great thing about core tin is that once you get some moisture on it, it patinas to a really earthy brown color. And when you first put it up and it's still got that tinny look to it, I had several people ask me when we're going to paint the property. but that's fine, because when it does patina, you'll see probably by the end of this next rainy season, you'll see a very soft medium brown patina on it, which will change the whole look of the building as well. And I'm seeing a lot of it around town here, actually. So this is not the only building that this is new at. I mean, I see it by the railroad station. It's the same type of construction, same type of patining of the core 10. There's a lot of core 10 around town.
Now, this space takes up like a whole block downtown, right? The hotel, correct?
I would have to say about a fourth of the block, right?
About a fourth of the block, all right.
Well, we're between Palm and Monterey. And then below us, you have the shops on Monterey. And then, of course, on the other side of Palm, you have the parking garage.
So when new things come to town, one of the biggest concerns is traffic and parking. How have y'all been able to sort of mitigate those issues?
Well, we're working with the city. There are a couple things we're doing. On the parking side, we have parking on the property. So all guests coming to the property have the choice of valet parking. And valet parking, based on what we worked out with the city, is mandatory for guests coming to the hotel. As far as associates driving in, we're working with them alternative transportation, letting them know what's available, where it is, and facilitating that, whether it's an expense, whether they're busing or cycling to work, whatever the case is. So try and mitigate the amount of traffic that we create for the associates in the hotel, and try and create an environment where if you do come to the hotel, it's easy to take care of and parking's taken care of. So I did hear when I first arrived here that at one point there was a parking lot there, but we want to enhance what's available downtown, not be a part of taking away.
SLO is growing. Tourism is one of our biggest drivers. So who does Hotel SLO hope to bring into this community?
Hotel SLO wants to service the people that are already coming to the community, that maybe we're looking for an alternative, maybe for something different. Obviously, the proximity to Cal Poly and the parents that come on the weekend to see their family members. I think people underestimate the business climate of SLO, too. Even people that have lived here don't realize you know, what that is and how much there is there. And with the airport and the direct flights, we want to make sure that we're an additional offering in town that maybe didn't exist 5 years ago, but because of the type of people that are coming, whether you're driving from LA to San Francisco and stopping through, or whether you're making a trip from the East Coast, or whether you're coming here to see your children, we have an alternative to offer now.
Well, with the rooms around, what, $400 to $1,000 a night? Is that
That's
roughly?
Correct. That's correct.
So this would be probably for people with a little bit more change to spend in their pocket, correct?
You know, it's been interesting. I mean, of course, a weekday in November, you can get a room for less than that. I think next week I have rooms available for $329 for the week. And just similar to what everybody's used to, the airlines, you do it based on demand. But yeah, the rates are in the high 300s to 1,000. And thus far, there's been very little resistance for that. So there seems to be a market out there that's looking for that.
So of the hotel your size, you probably employ a lot of people. How many people do you have on staff?
We'll have about 150 employees, some part-time. And then as we ebb and tide into the summer months when it gets busy, you could see that census drop up or jump up another 90 people perhaps. The biggest areas are obviously our food and beverage areas. When the restaurants are going, the three bars and the conference and catering, it takes a lot of people to make that happen and make it happen appropriately.
Do y'all still have job employment opportunities for people?
We always have employment opportunities. We'll take an application. You can apply online. We've been very fortunate. I will say that the team members have selected, I'm impressed with, and it's been a great start having this many people. I was concerned because unemployment is at a very low rate. I think the lowest in 50 years. But we've been very fortunate with the people we've been able to select.
That was David Smith, manager of Hotel San Luis Obispo, which recently opened its doors in downtown SLO. You're tuned to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. When we talk about climate change and greenhouse gases in California, it's tough to ignore the dairy industry. State data estimate dairies to be responsible for about 3% of the state's annual greenhouse gas emissions, mostly due to burping cows and fermenting manure. Although the industry has already made some reductions to its emissions, a recent state law requires the industry to reduce its methane footprint even further over the next decade. How will dairies accomplish that goal, and are they on track to meet it? From member station Valley Public Radio, Carrie Klein speaks with Michael Bocadoro. He's the executive director of the industry coalition Dairy Cares. They talk about how dairies in the San Joaquin Valley are embracing emission-reducing technologies called methane digesters.
Dairy Cares is a coalition that the dairy industry put together about 18 years ago to come together and work on sustainability issues. They're becoming very important, not just from a state policymaking basis in dealing with issues like climate change and water quality, but also from a consumer standpoint. Consumers want to know more about how their food's produced, and Cares was put in place by the California industry to help accomplish that.
And so are dairies sustainable in the long term?
They are. They're sustainable today here in California, and they're getting more sustainable. We're doing a great job. It's a great story that the California dairy industry can tell about its sustainability, its carbon footprint in particular, and how we're taking that even to the next level.
Right. And so today we're specifically talking about methane emissions from dairies. So methane, a potent greenhouse gas, it's produced in dairies in two main ways, by cow burps, but also by fermenting manure. And the manure emissions are now being kind of targeted by projects called digesters. 30 or so are now in operation in California, dozens more are in development. They process manure in a way that captures a lot of that methane that would otherwise be released in the atmosphere. Can you explain a little bit more about how these digesters work?
Sure. It's a great story. So we're taking basically cow manure, and we're turning it now into electricity, renewable electricity, and what we call carbon negative transportation fuel. So it's a fairly simplistic process. The manure is put into a digester where the gas can then be captured. So in a lot of dairies here in California, that's simply covering an existing manure lagoon where we store manure until we can utilize it as fertilizer for our growing operations. We are allowed to then capture the methane, and we can clean and condition that methane and actually turn it into low carbon or even zero carbon or negative carbon transportation fuel here in California. We're replacing diesel, and so we're not only getting greenhouse gas benefits, but we're getting air quality benefits by also reducing NOx.
And so when you look at the list of all the digesters either in operation or in production, I mean, almost every one of them is here in the San Joaquin Valley.
Almost all of them are here in the San Joaquin Valley. There are a couple up in the Sacramento Valley, and there are a couple up on the North Coast. But for the most part, yes, the overwhelming majority of our dairies are in the San Joaquin Valley. And so it's natural that the overwhelming majority of the digesters would be here as well.
And then there are a couple of different models, right, where the digesters themselves go on individual dairies, but then you have some newer projects happening that are kind of big clusters of digesters?
Yeah, we have a number of clusters that are going in here in the San Joaquin Valley, and these are clusters of existing dairies. These aren't new dairies that are coming into production. These are existing dairies that are working together as a cluster to more efficiently and economically build these projects. And what they're, the basic model is what we call a hub and spoke. And so the hubs are each of the individual the spokes are each of the individual dairies, and the hub is the centralized cleaning and conditioning facility where we can then inject the gas into the pipeline.
And of course, not all perspectives on methane digesters are totally positive. There are a lot of environmental groups who have pushed back, arguing either that dairies are still unsustainable even with these reductions, or that dairy producers may now actually be incentivized to kind of grow their operations? I mean, what, you know, are these fair assessments?
Let's start with the latter one first, the growing, and that's really not happening here in California. We are actually seeing a reduction both in the number of dairies and in the number of cows that we have in operation here in California for the first time. So we reached a peak about 2012 or 2013. Mm-hmm. We're always going to see consolidation in the dairy industry. We've been seeing that for 75 years. We have fewer larger dairies every year here in California. It's a tough place to be in the dairy business, in part because of our environmental and labor and other laws that we don't see in other states. And so I'm not sure it's a fair assessment, certainly on that front. And I think from a sustainability standpoint, the dairy industry also is making tremendous strides. We've been reducing the carbon footprint of a glass of milk for over 50 years. And today we have far fewer cows than we had 50 years ago, both here in the United States and in other parts of the world, producing more milk. And on a national basis, we have about a third the cows that we had 50 years ago. We're producing 60% more milk. So what that means from a carbon footprint standpoint is that we've dramatically reduced by over 60% the carbon footprint of a glass of milk. And so you can feel really good about drinking milk today and should feel really good about drinking milk. And the beauty is we've got a great story to tell because we're making that better. Dairies are putting in solar projects on their dairies, renewable energy projects on a regular basis. We've got 70 in Tulare County alone and well over 100 here in the San Joaquin Valley. More and more dairies are putting in digesters. We're working across the board energy efficiency to produce more milk with fewer natural resources, fewer fossil fuels, less water, across the board sustainability improvements. So yeah, it can be frustrating when we continue to still get criticism, but California should certainly, and the dairy families here, certainly keep their heads high because they're doing far better than anywhere else in the world. It's a tremendous story and we're going to keep telling it.
And so do these energy projects, do they make dairies, individual dairies in the dairy industry, more economically viable?
It's still to be learned for sure, but the economics have to make sense for these projects. They're not inexpensive projects, and even though there is some grant funding available, that grant funding is being matched on a 2 or 3 to 1 basis by outside investment, either from the dairies or other investors. And so they absolutely have to make economic sense or they wouldn't be going in. And so everything we've structured here in California with reducing dairy methane is all through incentive programs designed to get those reductions and do it in such a way that we're not putting the dairies out of business. And if we did, all that would happen is those cows and that production would move elsewhere and we'd actually worsen the environmental issues because we'd be producing more methane. We're far more efficient here in California than we are in other countries and some other states. And so really important that we do it the way we're doing it. And the beauty is it's working. We're making great progress in terms of achieving what the state's asking us to achieve. And what the state's asking was fairly aggressive.
Right. And so by 2030, according to state law, dairies are required to cut methane emissions by 40%. Are we on track to do that?
We are. And CDFA just last week, the California Department of Food and Agriculture just last week announced that we're already more than 60% of the way to achieving that 40% reduction. We've got 25 of that 40% already with just the projects that have been funded to date. They're not all built yet, but as they come online, we're more than on our way, and we're just 3 years into the new requirements and the new goals that the state has set for the dairy industry. And we're working to even surpass those goals to the degree that we can.
Great. Well, Michael Bocadoro is Executive Director of Dairy Cares. Thanks so much, Michael.
Thank you.
You You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all of our guests and contributors this week. I'm Tyler Pratt. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or listen to past segments. It's all at kcbx.org.